Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll delve into the issue of political violence. It's not just showing up on the national stage. Local politicians are feeling threatened as well. We'll hear from State Assembly member Mia Bonta, State Senator Scott Wiener, and San Francisco State political science professor Jason McDaniel about what can be done about it. We'll also ask our guests about their thoughts of President Biden dropping out of the presidential race. But first, the 2024 Summer Olympics begin this Friday in Paris, France. It's always more fun to tune in when you have someone to root for. So tonight we're going to hear about Bay Area athletes who are headed to the Games. They're competing in marquee events like swimming and track and field, but also in newer events like taekwondo and kiteboarding. Ann Killian, who's a sports columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, spoke with many of the Bay Area athletes headed to Paris, and she's going to give us the inside scoop. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Ann.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to Paris for the Olympics, and it's one of the world's most glamorous cities. And this Olympic Games follows two COVID-era games. What's the vibe like? What are you looking forward to?
Well, having been in Tokyo, I'm looking forward to seeing humans in the stands and not having to spit into a tube every day. But I think there's a lot of anticipation about these games because it's been a while since there's been Olympics that is looked forward to in this way. Maybe since London in 2012, we had the Sochi Olympics. We had another Winter Olympics in Korea. The last one was in Beijing. Not the most welcoming places in the world. Tokyo obviously was shut down to fans. Rio was kind of a disaster. They pulled it off, but you know, there was so much concern about how they were going to pull it off and what it was costing the country and corruption. So this is feels like it's supposed to be a jumpstart of the Olympic movement. Not that it isn't going to come with its own issues, but it's in a gorgeous city. This is the third time Paris will have hosted the Olympics in its history. There's fabulous athletes. The setting should be great. It's also happening at a time of incredible turmoil in the world, and there's a lot of concerns about security and safety and all of those things. So, you know, I'm not sure how they're going to pull it off, but it's definitely something that people have been looking forward to for a while during these Olympic cycles that have been a little bit less than satisfying.
Well, the Bay Area usually sends a pretty large complement of athletes to the Olympics. And I always like starting with one of my favorite events, which is swimming. So there's some amazing swimmers headed to the Olympics. I'm thinking of Katie Ledecky, who swam at Stanford, and Ryan Murphy from Cal, among others. Is there a strong group of Bay Area athletes on the U.S. swim team this year?
There is, if we get to claim Katie. Do we still get to claim her?
I think so.
Well, she's from Bethesda and she's now training in Florida, but she's a Stanford grad and very proud Stanford grad and trained here for years. And, you know, this will be the fourth Olympics I've covered her at. She was 15 in London. And then after she kind of became a superstar in Rio, that's when she entered Stanford as a freshman. And she's kind of amazing in terms of her just domination of the distance events. But there are young up-and-comers, so it's definitely going to be fun to watch. Tori Husk is a butterflyer from Stanford. Cal is sending a very strong contingent of swimmers. But to be honest, my favorite swimmer is from Oakland, but he's actually Russian. He is a lone swimmer competing as a, they have to compete as individual neutral athletes because Russia and Belarus are banned from the Olympics over the invasion of Ukraine. And so Yev, this swimmer who's been living in the United States for 7 years in Oakland since 2022, I think, coaching kids, he swam the third fastest breaststroke time in the world this year and has this amazing story, has basically had to figure out a way to get himself to the Olympics kind of solo. And I wrote a story about him that ran in the Chronicle, and he's really a charming guy who's kind of just, you know, he's Team Somoff, as he says. He's an athlete on an island.
Well, and that's Evgeny Somoff, right, mm-hmm. who you're talking about. Did he crowdsource his funds to get there, or how did he afford?
People reached out to me about him because people really love him. He's quite charming. And so the parents of kids he coaches or some of his own master swimmers that he coaches, a lot of them started a GoFundMe to help him raise the funds. He has to buy his own suits, his own uniform, do his own travel. He can't accept any funds from the Russian government. He had to figure out a way to get drug tested, which was his biggest hurdle because he needed 4 drug tests, but he hadn't even really been competing, and Russia isn't going to test him, and we're not going to test him because he's not a U.S. athlete. So it's been quite a journey, but it'll be fun to see him there. He's actually competing his semifinals the very first day of the Olympics.
What's the venue for swimming? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about swimming in the Seine, the river, but I don't think that's what's happening with these athletes.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. It's a new venue that they've built. But the Seine will be the open water swims and the triathlon. And, you know, there's concern about the safety, the bacteria levels. Seems to be a recurring theme. It certainly was one in Rio with pollution in the waters off of the city. Taylor Thibb, she's actually an amazing story. She's going to be in the time trial for bike and also in the triathlon. She qualified for the Olympics in the Seine and she didn't seem worried about it. So when you do enough Olympics, there's always recurring stories. And one of them is pollution in the waterways.
Well, I guess take antibiotics, assuming that those are okay for drug testing.
Exactly.
Well, another crowd pleaser is obviously track and field. I mean, that's a core Olympic event. The Bay Area isn't really well known for producing runners the way it has swimmers, but I understand we're sending a few runners to Paris. Who are they and what should we know about them?
Well, we have some field athletes as well from the local colleges, Cal and Stanford, but we do have Fiona O'Keefe. She's an amazing story. She was a distance runner at Stanford. She's from Davis, and she qualified for the Olympic marathon in her very first marathon that she ever ran. Her first
wow.
She ever ran was at the trials, and she won it. She won it in a record time. So that's going to be fun to see her. The women's marathon is the final day of the Olympics, and, you know, gorgeous, of course, through the streets of Paris. What could be better? So that'll be a very exciting story. We also have an athlete named Nikki Hiltz, who's grew up in Aptos, blew the doors off the 1500 up in Eugene at the track trials. And they are an interesting story. They, them pronouns, non-binary, already probably getting a lot of crap from the trolls online. Mm. Maybe a story, also maybe a medal contender. So there are definitely really interesting athletes in the track and field universe as well as the swimming universe.
Well, I'm excited to watch that one. I think that's going to be fun. And okay, so I'm going to write that down. Nikki Hiltz from Aptos in the 1500.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, Bay Area loves its soccer, and women's soccer is sending, I think, 5 Stanford players to Paris. Are those players going to help the U.S. team get their mojo back? There have been some recent disappointments.
Yeah, there have been some recent disappointments, and it's really interesting. I've been covering the Olympics for a very long time. My first Summer Olympics was the first time there was women's soccer. So I saw them win gold medals, make every final. And then starting in Rio, it kind of fell apart. They didn't make it out of group play. In Tokyo, they won a bronze. The world of women's soccer has changed dramatically. They just got some very bad news that Katerina Makar, who went to Stanford and is, you know, just a fabulous player, but has really had a tough recovery from a knee injury. It's been more than 2 years. And she made the team, and now she's going to be scratched because her knee isn't right. So they're going to have their work cut out for them. I didn't watch their game against Mexico the other night, but my friends who did said, ooh, don't count on seeing them in the gold medal game. So we'll see. They have a brand new coach, Emma Hayes. A lot of the longtime stars have retired. Cal's Alex Morgan didn't even make this team. It's going to be a different look, and the competition is going to be really fierce, including in their group. They're in a group with Germany and Australia, and It's going to be tough. Yeah. Yeah. So they'll be very interesting. My schedule has me going to Marseille the second day of the Olympics, which is where they are going to play their second group play game. And I believe it's Germany. Yeah.
Mm. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that. I mean, another popular sport is basketball, and it always feels like the U.S. team fields just real pros. And this year we've got Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr is going to be there, and Steph Curry is playing in his, I think, his first Olympic appearance.
He's played for Olympics. Yeah. It's a big deal.
It's a big deal. I mean, maybe makes up for the lack of getting into the finals of this past season.
Wow, you have a pretty high bar to clear.
I mean, well, is the U.S. favored to win gold? I mean, they have quite a lineup.
They are favored to win gold. They're always favored to win gold. They have an incredible lineup. It's kind of an old lineup. I mean, Steph's on the team and so is LeBron. So is Kevin Durant. I mean, these guys are not in their prime anymore. You know, ever since the Dream Team was assembled back in 92 with Michael Jordan and Larry Bird, and just, you know, it's kind of been expected that the U.S. with its NBA stars will dominate. And it's kind of expected this year, but there's a lot of excitement in France because France has their fantastic young player, Wemby, who plays for San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And France has a whole bunch of, I think the top two or three draft picks were French. They have depth. They're good. People are very excited in France about their team. So they're a contender. And as we know from just watching the NBA, it's an incredibly international game now. And it's just like for the U.S. women in soccer, it is not a walk in the park. And, you know, they have struggled. They struggled in Tokyo a little bit. I think Las Vegas thinks that the U.S. will win gold, but I don't think it's going to be just a romp. And it's interesting because the basketball group play competition, both the men's and the women's, is taking place in Lille. So it's about 2.5 hours by train outside of Paris. And then the knockout rounds will be in Paris. But I understand that this version of the Dream Team, or whatever you want to call it, is going to be taking a private train back and forth from Lille, for where they have games, to Paris. So,
well, I think they can afford it. I think there are a couple of guys on that team who could pick up the tab.
And of course, Steve Kerr is the coach. So we've got a lot of interest from the Bay Area in that team.
Well, let's turn to some sports that don't get as much attention as the Dream Team and the Golden State Warriors players and the Olympics. And let's start with Taekwondo. You spoke with CJ Nicholas, who is from Oakland. Tell us about his journey to the Olympics.
He's a really charming young man. I mean, anyone who talks to that young man is going to start rooting for him. He started Taekwondo when he was just a little guy. His mom talked him into a class when he was, I don't think he was supposed to be in until he was 5, and he was like 3. And he's just risen through the ranks, loves it. His mother actually competed too, because rather than leave him and go pick up his sister, she stayed in the class when he was little and did Taekwondo in the back.
Oh.
But it's a sport we don't know a lot about. It's a fighting sport. I think he's a real contender. He's a really neat kid who kind of just has grown up. Like, his mom had to let him go when he was like a really young, she said very young, 17-year-old. And he moved first to England to train, and then to Colorado Springs, and then to, he's in North Carolina. And he's someone I think the Bay Area should really enjoy rooting for.
We'll have to look out for CJ. You also interviewed Danielle Moroz. She's competing in the first, in kiteboarding, which is the first time it will be in the Olympics. What should we know about Daniela?
Well, she grew up in Lafayette. She is a Campo Lindo grad, but also she was kiteboarding or windsurfing. She was on the water before she was ever born. Her parents have this amazing story. They both escaped individually, not together, from Czechoslovakia in 1983. And her father actually cross-country skied across the Alps to freedom. And they both ended up in the Bay Area and were both at the Berkeley Marina trying to figure out what this crazy windsurfing was, and heard there was a group of people and they're all talking, speaking Czech, and they connected and became friends, and then they got married. And so they've been on the water together, racing and having fun. And then her mom, Linda, completed a very difficult race that is famous in windsurfing circles while she was pregnant with Daniela. So she's just always known what to do. And I think kiteboarding is going to be really cool. Now, unfortunately, it's in Marseille, so I probably won't get to spend a lot of time covering it, but it's going to be the fastest sport is what it's being advertised as. She's going like 40 miles an hour.
Wow.
So it's exciting. And she grew up learning how to do it, you know, under the Golden Gate Bridge in our waters. So she's a hometown kid.
Well, I heard that events, I mean, obviously they're spread out through the country. I heard that surfing is in Tahiti. So,
yeah, surfing is in Tahiti. There just aren't enough waves in the summertime anywhere off the coast of France. But other than that, you know, the sailing is in the Mediterranean and it's a little more spread out than it usually is. Usually the host city has most of the events, but in this case, there's more throughout France and then a global reach to Tahiti.
Well, we have a short clip from actually a sailor who's going to be at the Olympics.
I've been sailing and competing in San Francisco Bay for the past 20 years. I grew up sailing in Southern California, but would travel to the Bay Area multiple times during the year to compete at many different regattas and multiple different clubs all around the Bay. More recently, I've been actively training in San Francisco to prepare for the Paris Olympics. SF is an iconic and world-renowned sailing venue. It is known globally for its challenging conditions, especially in the summer, and is one of the best places in the world to train and to race. To state it simply, the Bay Area has been instrumental in my development as a sailor. The diverse and challenging conditions here in SF have always pushed me outside my comfort zone, and that's where I've learned the most about my sailing. Additionally, the Bay Area sailing community has been incredibly supportive, offering opportunities to learn from some of the best sailors in the world. I owe much of my growth and success to the experiences and mentors I've found in the Bay Area.
So that was Hans Henken. He is talking about how the Bay Area has played a key role in helping him achieve his dream of going to the Olympics in sailing. And what should we know about Hans and his journey to the Olympics?
Well, he's a Stanford guy, and he's a really interesting person. He missed out making Rio. His younger sister actually made Rio, and he went back to Stanford, and he got his master's in... He's an engineer, and... He is concerned that sailing, it's a really expensive sport. It's a very elite sport. And obviously the Olympics are trying to make their sports more accessible. You know, they're putting in breakdancing this year for the first time. We've got skateboarding again. So they're trying to kind of connect with a different group of interests than just the elite old time sports. Sailing has been in the Olympics. It's always been in the Olympics. It used to be called yachting. So Hans is trying to kind of sell his sport as such a exciting, again, fast. He compares it to like F1 and he thinks there should be like a Drive to Survive for sailors. And he really is very good at talking about what a problem solving sport it is and how it stimulates his engineering brain as well as his physical skills. So, you know, again, he claims the St. Francis Yacht Club as his home club, and he lived for a while in San Francisco. He and his wife now live in Barcelona. She's also an engineer and works for an America's Cup team. So it's very strategic, very interesting. You know, they have to figure out what goes wrong when their boat breaks. Things that, you know, someone who's running down a track, they don't have to do those kind of things necessarily. So all these sports have their own cool little kind of individual things that attract a certain kind of athlete that can excel in them.
Well, Anne, you've given us a lot to think about and a lot of people to watch at the Olympics this year. And that was Anne Killian. She's a sports columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle, and she'll be writing about our Bay Area athletes as they compete in the games. Thanks so much for joining us, Anne.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll discuss the new landscape of the presidential election and how legislators are responding to threats of violence. Stay with us.
SFUSD Student Nutrition Services will be offering one breakfast and one lunch to any young person 18 years old and younger at no cost at over 60 schools with summer school throughout July. One does not need to be enrolled in summer school to access a meal on site. The only rule is no grab-and-go meals. Please visit sfusd.edu/schoolfood for more up-to-date information on the summer meal program.
Well, welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. The news moves fast, and it seems just like weeks ago, not 9 days ago, that former President Trump was shot at and injured during a campaign rally in Pennsylvania. Political violence is not just a national issue. It's a local one as well. To talk about the threats faced by politicians, tonight we're joined by State Senator Scott Wiener, State Assembly Member Mia Bonta, as well as San Francisco State Political Science Professor Jason McDaniel. Welcome back to all of you.
Thank you.
Great. But before we get into that important issue, I wanted to start with the news that has dominated the headlines in the last 24 hours. And that, of course, is Joe Biden dropping out and San Francisco's own Kamala Harris taking over as a presidential candidate. And listeners, we want you to be part of the next conversation. What's your reaction to the news that Biden has stepped down? And are you excited about Vice President Harris taking on a new role as the Democratic presidential candidate? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kaow.org. Well, Senator Wiener, I wanted to start with you because I saw your Instagram post giving a big shout out to Kamala Harris. Our producer, Chris Nooney, calls it Kama Love. Tell me about how you're feeling about Harris taking on this new role.
Well, I have a lot of Kama Love in my heart. I am incredibly excited. I supported Kamala Harris in 2020, and obviously it didn't work out, but sometimes things don't work out the first try. And I first want to say, I adore Kamala, I support her 1,000%. I just want to take a moment to really thank President Biden. This is someone who's devoted his entire life to his country. And he, as president, people can agree or disagree, with any given thing, but he delivered big time on climate, on infrastructure, on so many key issues. And he now is putting the country ahead of his own personal ambitions. And so I just want to really tip my hat to the president. And in terms of Vice President Harris, I've known her for 22 years, back to when she was running for district attorney in 2002, 2003. And I was a campaign volunteer, and I would at times be out with her at 6 a.m. at a subway stop or doing bar crawls with her. And it's the amazing thing about democracy, that you could be out handing out flyers with a candidate, and then a couple decades later, they're hopefully going to be president of the United States.
Well, do I have this right, Senator Wiener, that at some point you crossed paths with her at the city attorney's office because you both were working in City Hall at the same time?
Yeah. So when I first joined the city attorney's office in 2002, she was already there, and then she was there probably for another 6 or 9 months after I got there. And then she took a leave of absence to run for district attorney, and I volunteered with her campaign.
Assemblymember Mia Bonta, I also saw that you were very enthusiastic about a Harris candidacy. Tell us something about Harris that you would want the rest of the nation to know, because she's not very well defined at this point.
I think I'd want everyone to know that our vice president and hopefully our future president is a daughter of Oakland, something that we are all very proud of. She holds her Oakland roots near and dear to her. And I think the fact that we are going to have a Black API woman is groundbreaking, earth-shattering moment for us. And the pride that we all feel, particularly for me as a Black woman, that we will have a woman president is beyond. And I know that that is held by many in our community.
Well, certainly her candidacy has been energizing. The media is reporting that in the last 24 hours, she has raised $81 million over some thousands of donors. Not clear if they're small donors or large donors. I mean, Assemblymember Bonta, do you think that Harris at the top of the ticket will allow other candidates on below the ticket, below that line, to rise up?
I think the energy that we felt over the last 24 hours in large response to, quite frankly, President Biden's incredible grace and humility and desire to make sure that the Democratic Party and our democracy is protected and will thrive is really just been spurred on by that our vice president is at the head of that ticket. And I definitely think it will have a very positive impact on down ballot races, which we so desperately need in our congressional races and even in some of our statewide assembly and legislative races as well.
Well, Jason McDaniel, as a political scientist, this must have been a big 24 hours for you.
It's only been 24 hours. Wow.
I mean, you know, what do you think it means when an incumbent steps down like this late in the game? I mean, we're hearing lots of pundits say like, oh, you know, the Democratic Party has us together. But on the other side, there is a lot of criticism saying, wow, that party looks like it doesn't have its act together by coming in so late in the game like this.
Well, I think this is an unprecedented display of unity of the Democratic Party and strength of its leaders Biden had lost the confidence of the party, and this was a very difficult, unprecedented thing that the party has done. And I think, you know, former Speaker Pelosi is a big force and influence in making that tough decision. But what it does is, I think, you know, as Assemblywoman Bonta said, it unites the party and excites them. Kamala Harris has united the party. There's a lot of enthusiasm right now, and I think we'll see that going forward, much more so than there was for President Biden. She's got some vulnerabilities. There's no doubt about that. The idea, I was scoffing with my students a year ago, the idea that a party would replace an incumbent when the economy is doing well is about the most absurd thing you can think of, especially one who had beaten the same candidate 4 years ago. And yet that had changed, and it became very clear that Biden was going to have a very difficult time winning this election if it was at all possible. And now it's back to being at least a 50-50 race, and I think that's something that Democrats want. They want to be able to take the message to Trump and make the election about Trump, and Kamala Harris has the chance to do that.
Well, it reminds me of in 1991, the first George H.W. Bush had incredible ratings after the invasion of Iraq, and he seemed absolutely unbeatable. And then Clinton came in and beat him in 92. So do you think that Harris will have that rocket fuel to take her all the way, Jason?
Yeah, I'm not gonna compare her to Clinton necessarily. It's a different situation. You make me think of something, though. I was at a panel with a certain buddy who worked on that campaign on the George H.W. Bush side. And, you know, you may recall that after his popularity, the economy was bad and his popularity tanks, right? And yet during the election itself, the economy had started to improve. And what they had found is that they could not do anything to get the country to believe that. They couldn't change George H.W. Bush's numbers. They were set in stone no matter what they did. And so Clinton was able to win on that message of the economy being bad, even though it had started to show improvements. And this person drew an analogy to President Biden at the time. And I think perhaps there's a lot of truth to that. And that's no longer the case with Kamala Harris. Now, she may not be able to make that economic message the way she wants. We'll have to find out and see. But I guarantee you she's now got Democrats more excited, especially facing the prospect of a second Trump administration. I don't think they'll have any problem appealing, especially to, I think, younger voters and voters of color, especially in the African-American community. I think already you see more excitement. There would have been strong support for Biden anyway, but I'm seeing a lot of upside for a Kamala Harris campaign, a candidacy in this short amount of time we have left.
Scott Wiener, I wanted to go back to you. I mean, the rest of the country often looks at California and says, oh, California politics, I don't want them in my state. How does being from California help Kamala Harris and hurt Kamala?
Well, I mean, you know, people love to, you know, take whacks at California and, of course, nothing more so than San Francisco. But, you know, Kamala, I think she is a national figure, right? She's not running for president as coming out of, you know, California or the Bay Area per se. She's the vice president of the United States. having already served in the United States Senate and being a career prosecutor as a line prosecutor and then an elected district attorney and then the attorney general of California. So people can have whatever opinions they want about California. If you want to make fun of us, great, go ahead and do it. But I think at this point, Kamala is a national presence and a national leader.
Jason, did you want to add to that?
Well, I agree with Senator Wiener. I will say that there is something about the California connection that highlights one of her main, if not her main potential vulnerability, which is that she did have a voting record in the Senate as more liberal than President Biden. It is quite possible that she will be perceived to be more liberal than the average median voter and more distant from them than President Trump. This is something we saw in 2016. Candidates who are women, people of color, candidates who are women and people of color are often unfairly perceived to be more liberal and more extreme than they are. And I think that California connection is another shortcut that low information voters might use to say, oh, this is a person of color, this is a woman of color, this is from California, she's too liberal, right? And so that is, I think, the major vulnerability for Vice President Kamala Harris, but they'll have a chance to rectify that, but it's going to be a difficult push.
You know, Assemblymember Bonta, I wanted to ask you, you are a woman, you're a woman of color. On the one hand, that's something that's just inimically part of who you are. But I'm hearing a lot of conversation in the media saying, let's not talk about Vice President Harris as a DEI candidate. Let's talk about her as a candidate. What do you think is the right approach here? Should she be talking about her background, or should she be saying, hey, I'm just a candidate?
I think all of us talk about and approach the work that we do in public office from the experience that we hold and the generational experience from which we come. So she is going to be our candidate. She is going to be a phenomenal candidate. She has all of the national and international skill and acumen as vice president to be able to hold her own and surpass the rhetoric that we will face with the Trump candidacy. But we, at the end of the day, she is somebody who's going to bring all of her identity and herself to the table. And I see that as an incredible strength. She represents the diversity and the path of what it means to be an immigrant in the United States and what that can mean. She is literally the definition of the American dream. And she is living my wildest dream as somebody from the state of California in the U.S. So I'm incredibly proud of her.
Well, before Sunday's news from President Biden, we had slated this show to talk about political violence, and I wanted to turn back to that. And you know, this is a bit of a hard left or right turn. Pick your direction. But you know, we are facing a time when the rhetoric is really tough out there. And, you know, we witnessed the attempted assassination of President Donald Trump. Still don't know what the motives of that shooter were. I mean, Senator Wiener, are you worried about the increase in rhetoric and just for the national race? And we're going to get to the local stuff after that. But are you concerned about what might happen?
I'm concerned about the rhetoric, but I want to be really clear also, and I this is not like an equal both sides situation. And yes, of course, violence can come from anywhere, and we have, you know, we saw when Steve Scalise was badly injured by someone who I think identified, you know, as a progressive of some sort, but that's the exception, not the rule. Overwhelmingly, when we look at the violence and the threats of violence, it's coming from folks from coming out of some sort of right wing background. You look at the militias and the Proud Boys and you know what's happening online. It is largely a right wing phenomenon, and so yeah, it does concern me. And obviously what happened with Donald Trump was horrible. I don't wish that on anyone, even someone as awful as Donald Trump. No one deserves to be the victim of of violence. And it also shows that even for someone who's a major presidential candidate who has Secret Service protection, you know, nothing is foolproof. And so it is a feature of modern politics. Unfortunately, in the United States, we've gone through waves of political violence over the last 200 plus years, and we just have to be mindful of that.
Well, let me introduce this program. You're listening to State at the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're joined tonight by State Senator Scott Wiener, State Assembly Member Mia Bonta, as well as San Francisco State Political Science Professor Jason McDaniel. And we're talking about the rise in political violence, not just on the national level, but also on a local level. A recent study by the Brennan Center for Justice found that more than 40% of local or state lawmakers had received threats of harm or suffered physical attacks. And we want you to be part of this next conversation, listeners. Are you concerned about the increase in violence directed at our legislators, judges, and other public servants? What ideas do you have for how we might calm things down? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Senator Wiener, I wanted to go back to you because you are dealing with a particularly difficult situation right now. Over the weekend, Elon Musk, who now owns X, formerly known as Twitter, he tweeted that you are, quote, a pedophile apologist, end quote, because you co-authored legislation to protect trans kids from forced outing. That post has been viewed 50 million times. And I understand from your office that you have been flooded with death threats since that tweet was posted.
Yes. Elon Musk is he's problematic for a lot of different reasons. And he is now a primary generator. He and his platform X, primary generator of transphobic rhetoric, homophobic rhetoric, and anti-Semitic rhetoric, which he did a bunch of anti-Semitic stuff just today. So he's Elon Musk is a hugely problematic person, and yes, we've gotten a whole bunch of death threats since he tweeted about me. I mean, just totally defamed me, slandered me, libeled me on Saturday. Unfortunately, I've been going for the last, it's been about 5 years now, that I've been getting a lot of death threats. Overwhelmingly, it's about work that we do to support LGBTQ young people, to make sure that LGBTQ young people who are at heightened risk of violence and self-harm and becoming homeless, that, you know, making sure that they are uplifted and understand that they have hope for the future. And the bill in particular that that Musk was attacking me on, I was not even the primary author. I was proud to be a co-author of it. It was a bill that said that school districts are not allowed to adopt blanket policies forcing teachers to immediately out LGBTQ kids to their parents. In other words, not that the teacher would have discretion, which they do and will continue to have, to decide if it's appropriate to call a parent to talk about something. That teachers have every right in the world to do that, and they continue to have that right. But school districts were literally dictating that a teacher, the minute they found out that a kid was using different pronouns or dressing in a different way, they would have to pick up the phone, call the parents, out the kid to the parent, potentially putting that child's life at risk if the parent was going to be violent towards the kid, or making the kid homeless because the kid gets kicked out. And so we banned school districts from forcing teachers to do that. It was the right thing to do. And the governor signed it. I want to thank him for signing that. And conspiracy theorists, transphobic conspiracy theorists like Elon Musk, are now trying to generate violence out of that. So it's really, really tragic.
I mean, these death threats that you get, and I mean, they have been not just with this bill, but other work that you have done. I mean, how much do they end up disrupting your life?
Well, it is disruptive. I mean, I've had the San Francisco Police Department bomb dog is now familiar with my home because we get bomb threats, and so you know, I mean, it disrupts my life, my poor neighbors who have to deal with that. And I also, my staff, who including, like, you know, young staffers and interns who are answering the phones and, you know, and reading, you know, emails that are just sometimes really vile, really, really disgusting and vile. And it is very disruptive. I don't like to talk about my security protocols publicly, but, you know, I have to be mindful. But it's not just me. I have colleagues in the legislature who get threats as well. I trigger the hard right in a certain way, but I have colleagues who have gotten threats. And I also just want to say that, you know, local elected officials, there are a lot of city council members from smaller cities, school board members who have no staff, very little support, and they are getting death threats as well. And so it is a broad-based issue.
Mm. I mean, Assemblymember Bonta, I'm curious, in your situation, have you also experienced these same threats, these threats of violence, I mean, insults? What has your experience been like?
My experience as a partner in life and service to somebody who was an elected, I've had my children lives threatened when I became a member of the California State Legislature. I was stalked. Yes, so we are, our family, I myself are no stranger to the kind of impact that political violence and negative political rhetoric can have on our sense of safety. And it is a very common feeling, unfortunately, for candidates. Senator Wiener and I are, you know, somewhat lucky, or at least have the resources of the California State Legislature to be able to ensure that we have some additional protections. But those protections ultimately are very limited. We're a body of 120 legislators, and there are only so many resources that can go towards protecting our homes, our offices, and the like. The reason why I presented AB 2041 was really watching other candidates, particularly other women candidates who were running in the cycle after I got elected, who were doxxed as candidates, who had to endure the same kind of online threats to their lives, calling to their homes, different things that just made it impossible for them to feel safe as candidates. And they have little to no resources and a greater sense of exposure, and are only able to avail themselves of the law enforcement that may or may not be responsive for any particular incident.
So you mentioned your bill, and maybe let's bring that up. I mean, your bill is to allow people who are running for office, as well as elected officials, to use their campaign funds for security. Is that correct?
Yes. So we can already do that. The Fair Political Practices Commission allows a $5,000 lifetime limit for safety and security expenses. But that's a very limited amount of funding that hasn't actually been adjusted for 30 years. And it requires, the current law requires that you can use your campaign funds only after there's been a verified threat by law enforcement. So it kind of puts us candidates and elected officials in a very tenuous state, because we have to do the work of experiencing the kind of harm that Senator Wiener talked about and that I've alluded to, and then have that all be verified. So this legislation, AB 2041, aims to remove the expenditure cap completely and allows candidates to be able to use those campaign funds for themselves, for their family members and their staff, which I think is very critical. And I've heard from a lot of legislators who are very appreciative of those components. And it also allows for candidates to be proactive in setting up the security measures and paying for those security measures out of their campaign funds.
Well, it seems like a common sense solution, but I understand that Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a similar type of bill earlier. Why is that?
I ran a very similar bill last legislative cycle. My understanding is that there was a concern with the definition of what would be considered security expense. So we've worked with the FPPC to be very clear on the definition of what a security expense would be. I think that there was some greater concern around the ability for people to purchase firearms with campaign funds and develop, you know, extensive arsenals, if you will, in the name of personal security. And I think that that is definitely a bridge too far, and which is why I amended the bill and brought it back in the hopes that the governor would sign the bill this time around.
Well, we have an email from Rich in Citrus Heights who writes, as far as political violence is concerned, Republicans wanted political violence, and on July 13th, that is what happened. My point is, don't be violent with someone unless you want them to be violent with you and you provoke it. I mean, Jason McDaniel, I wanted to bring you into this part of the conversation. I mean, this idea that the right kind of calls for violence was a big part of the conversation in politics last week, and President Biden went on with Lester Holt saying, hey, I shouldn't have used the word put Donald Trump a bullseye on him or put him in the crosshairs. What do you say about that rhetoric leading to actual violence? I mean, harsh rhetoric isn't new to American politics.
You know, there are a lot of studies in recent years on this idea of partisan motivated or political violence, and we've definitely seen increases in threats towards elected officials and government workers. You know, it is the, I think, contributing to our sense of historic and unstable political times, that it's no longer just violent rhetoric. It's politicians, especially predominantly in the Republican Party, that are endorsing violence against political opponents, dehumanizing political opponents, especially from marginalized communities and trans people and LGBT people, women and people of color, and kind of legitimizing threats and harassment towards them. But what we find, you know, that's all true. Endorsing lethal violence and engaging in it is still an incredibly rare thing, and it seems to be that there are psychological factors, especially something that's called trait aggression or a proclivity to violence, to engage in violence, which is a psychological condition. Maybe 1-2% of people surveyed in some of these experiments I've looked at will endorse lethal violence. Even fewer will engage in it. But there is no doubt in my mind that rhetoric from politicians that legitimize it is increasing these kinds of threats and increasing the actual acts of violence. And it's something that I think is just incredibly tragic and speaks to our times.
Well, Senator Wiener, I mean, if you want to be a politician, I mean, of course you have to have a thick skin. You have to deal with insults to yourself personally, to the work that you do. But I can imagine that this new threat, or maybe not new, but this increased threat of your own personal safety, I mean, it would discourage the average person from wanting to become a politician. I mean, I don't know who would want to do it, given all the things that you have discussed having to deal with. And I wonder, what do you say to people who are like, well, I'm thinking about running for office, but I don't want to deal with being doxxed, threatened, you know, subjected to violence? How do you keep people in the game?
Yeah, and one thing I just want to point out, and then I'll answer that, is, you know, what one thing that's interesting is after the attempted assassination of Donald Trump, and many of us were condemning, you know, political violence, and some people would say, well, what about, you know, the violence, you know, other forms of violence, politicians, just because, you know, all violence is bad. And of course, all violence is bad. But the what is additionally pernicious in terms of violence or threats of violence directed at elected officials or candidates is, yes, the violence itself, but also it is completely antithetical to democracy, because the minute, and this is the goal, but if you have elected officials, as an elected official, the only things I should be thinking about when I decide what bills I'm going to author, how I'm going to vote, what I'm going to do, I should be thinking about my own, my my values and the beliefs and needs of my constituents, and what is best for society. Those are what we should be thinking about as elected officials. Not, hey, if I introduce this bill, someone may shoot me, or if I vote this way, someone is going to physically harass me or threaten my family. The minute you have elected officials where that's going into the calculus, that undermines democracy, because then it's not just about what you think is the best path, what your constituents want and need. So I just want to sort of put that out there about why political violence is so pernicious, because it goes beyond the evil of violence itself that undermines democracy. But yeah, I think you have a lot of people who question, do I want to, politics can be so, rough. People are attacking you in a lot of different ways. And then, of course, the potential doxing, et cetera, and violence. And that is something that people have to consider. What I say to people is, it is a really hard job. You are giving up, you're sacrificing a lot of your life. And not just the fact that your evenings and your weekends are going to be devoted to the community, because you need to have that passion about the community, but that there are going to be other negative things that happen. But ultimately, you're going to be able to do a lot of good for the community. And yes, you may pay a price, but you're going to do work that's going to leave the community in a better place than when you started. And that is what it's about. And you have to always stay focused on the good that you can do to make people's lives better.
Well, earlier today, Kimberly Cheadle, who is the director of the Secret Service, went before Congress. She faced incredible criticism from both sides of the aisle for what people felt was, the Secret Service letting Trump down on the job. Mia Bonta, your bill is to allow candidates to access some monies to make sure that they're protected. Do you feel like that's even enough? If the Secret Service can't protect the president, it seems like small potatoes to just use campaign funds to try to protect yourself.
Well, I think it's certainly a very critical component of what is necessary. This bill is really trying to support the school board member, the city council member, the state legislator, the candidate who's running for assembly or senate. And it's also ensuring that we're not undermining our democracy. Our democracy is dependent on representational electeds, and we need the people who are serving for us to look like us and come from the backgrounds that we have. Because of the level of political violence that people experience, particularly women of color and LGBTQ women, we tend to not run. And so we can't have a situation where we need candidates to be representative of their communities, but not have the resources that they need to minimally feel safe with a security system or being able to hire somebody to attend an event who can provide added security for them. We can't remove that tool from candidates' toolbox and elected officials' toolbox. And that's simply put what this bill is intending to do as well.
Well, Mia Bonta, I wanted to ask you, Scott Wiener was saying that when you think about doing this job, you have to weigh the hardship of it against what good you can do. In your case, your husband's been threatened and even your children have been threatened. Is the good that you're able to do for your constituents enough to get you through those hard and tricky moments and scary moments?
I'm incredibly grateful for the opportunity that I have to serve my community in this capacity. I think every legislator would say that. I think we all go in with eyes wide open as we're candidates. And when we take that oath of office, I think what we should never have to do when we raise our hands and take an oath of office is say that we're giving an oath to give up our sense of safety. And I think that is not what should be expected of us.
Well, Assemblymember Mia Bonta, I want to thank you for your service. And also State Senator Scott Wiener, thank you for being politicians and putting up with what you do.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. And also thank you to San Francisco State Political Science Professor Jason McDaniel for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're going to have to leave it there. And thanks to all our listeners and callers for their comments and questions today. That's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we'll sit down with Daniel Lurie to hear why he thinks he should be San Francisco's next mayor. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen. You'll never miss an episode that way. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any comments or questions or maybe even a story idea, let us know. You can email us anytime at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. Emergence is next. Keep your radio on this dial. I'm Grace Wan. Good night. Thanks for listening.